Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is January 28, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Blood on Blood, Transfusion Strategies for Upper GI Bleeds. Today, I've got a guest skeptic again, and this person is part of the continuum of emergency medicine because we don't work in isolation, we work as a team. And I am proud to have Dr. Philip Rolla on the show, who's an ICU specialist. Dr. Rolla graduated from McGill University in internal medicine, so we know he's smart. And he's still the chief of the ICU at Santa Cabrini Hospital in Montreal and an attending ICU specialist at the Scarborough General Hospital in Toronto, Ontario. He's also the co-founder and president of Critical Care and Ultrasound Institute. He's a self-reported social media newbie, but Dr. Rolla came to my attention because, as a newbie, he wrote a great blog post on a paper we're going to review today. His blog post was called, quote, "But doctor, he's vomiting blood," end of quote. I thought it would be a great idea to have an ICU doctor looking at this paper with us. Welcome to the program, Dr. Rolla.
Thanks a lot, Ken, and I'm very happy to be here.
You sound like you're really busy going between Montreal and Toronto. You've got a very busy life. What's going on?
Pretty much. Well, my wife is finishing her residency here, and so until for another few months, we're doing both cities, but come summertime, we'll be back in Montreal.
Okay, so you'll be back in that city once again. I really enjoyed your blog posting. I thought it was really well written, and it was
much.
A paper that we were covering already in the Beam critical review process. So I thought this would be a great chance to marry the eMERGE expertise with the ICU expertise.
I think it's really important to understand that there really shouldn't be territoriality within acute care, whether someone's sick is coming from the ED, the OR, or the wards. They should receive the same level of care throughout, and that's really important for everyone to keep those communication lines open.
Absolutely, and that's why recently we had a couple of papers involving pre-hospital care and the EMS experts. So it's great to have someone at the higher end of the hospital. And what I mean by higher end is usually it's not on the first floor of the hospital. The ICU is somewhere higher up. That's what I mean by higher end. So let's start with a case scenario, because it's always nice to frame these things with a case and get our head around the actual issue. So the case that we put together today was a 62-year-old man arrives with hematemesis, and his blood pressure is 112 over 72. His heart rate is normal at 84, and he's got a hemoglobin of 82, and that's for our Canadian audience, or 8.2 grams per deciliter for our American audience. And the question we're looking at today is, which is better, a conservative or a liberal transfusion strategy for upper GI bleeds? So, Philip, for upper GI bleeds, I mean, we see this. This is bread and butter for emergency medicine. These people come to the eMERGE. And I'm not surprised. I mean, you start vomiting blood, people get a little anxious and call 911. And it does have a high morbidity and mortality rate. And we're always thinking transfusions, they can be life-saving, especially with massive bleeds. But my understanding is that there is some controversy when it comes to less than massive bleeds, and that literature is sort of coming out of the ICU literature. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that, Philip.
Sure. Well, I think if you take a look back on transfusion practice as a whole, mostly, like many things in medicine, it's really been guided by tradition, by each physician's opinion at the moment, by the emotion of, you know, even of seeing, you know, a lot of bleeding, especially trauma, GI bleeds, etc. And as for a lot of our practices, I think studies come up that show that, hey, some of the things that we do that are based in dogma and tradition and all that are not necessarily always a good thing. So I think the ICU literature, and actually, you know, we should be proud, because the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group, that Paul Hebert study in 1999, the TRIC trial, compared a restrictive strategy, 7.0 or 70, depending on which side of the border you stand on, or 90 as a transfusion threshold, and pretty much showed that the 70 was at least as safe and probably reduced some complications. And pretty much since then, I mean, it took a few years for that to slide in everywhere. But since then, in the ICU, the transfusion thresholds have been, you know, significantly lower. Now, that particular study did exclude the two groups of people for whom they just couldn't, you know, get over the hurdles to do it initially, which were GI bleeds and acute coronary syndromes. So this is all other patients than that, so they didn't assess this particular question. But thankfully, someone else did earlier this, last year, actually.
So that leads us to the paper we're going to be talking about today. So Villanova et al. Published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 2013 of January, Transfusion Strategies for Upper Gastrointestinal Bleeding. And when I read these papers, I'm always thinking I should remain critical and skeptical, even if it's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, because we can't just accept face validity that the conclusions have been supported. So what population were they dealing with specifically in the Villanova paper?
They really did look at upper GI bleeds. Basically, they had to be 18 years and older, had to present with either hematemesis or blood in the NG tube or melena or all of those. But they did exclude a number of important groups of patients. So obviously anyone who declined blood transfusion, massive bleeds. So I take it with lots of hemodynamic instability. They also excluded the acute coronary syndromes, and also the acute cerebral syndromes, TIAs or CVAs. Someone had recent transfusions, trauma or surgery. They excluded lower GI bleeds, and they excluded patients that, where the treating physician had made a decision to avoid specific medical therapy, or those with an extremely low Rockall score.
And we'll talk about the Rockall score shortly, because it's a grading system for people with this type of condition. But I think it's really important that people understand who was included and who was excluded from any study, so that they know if it has external validity to their population. And they got close to 1,000 patients. I think the actual number was 921, so a fairly large study when it comes to upper GI bleeds. They had two strategies for their intervention. One was restrictive or conservative, a restrictive strategy, and that was only transfusing if their hemoglobin was less than 7 or 70, and then a liberal strategy. And the liberal strategy was they would only provide transfusions if their hemoglobin was less than 9 or 90. And they didn't have a true control group, right? They just had these two strategies. You were going to either liberally give blood or restrictively or conservatively give blood, but they didn't have an actual control group. However, what was their primary outcome in this study?
They were looking at death at 45 days or occurrence of rebleeding and adverse outcomes. And as a quick little sideline, although they didn't have a control group, I think it's I think most people would acknowledge that the liberal strategy is what most people do nowadays. As a baseline, so that is close.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is evidence-based medicine, and sometimes it's not a black and white. It's a bit gray, and the liberal strategy would be more in line with the current standard of care that people were providing for people with upper GI bleeds. So let's talk a little bit about this Rockall score. I wasn't very familiar with it, probably because it involved endoscopic findings for stratifying these upper GI bleeds. But this scoring system attempts to identify patients at risks for adverse outcomes following upper GI bleeds. And Rockall et al. Identified independent risk factors almost 20 years ago. It was 1996. And these factors were shown to predict mortality fairly accurately. And the scoring system uses clinical criteria, and they are increased age, comorbidity or shock, as well as these endoscopic findings like the diagnosis on endoscopy and stigmata of acute bleed. A convenient mnemonic for it is ABCDE, and being an eMERGE doc, I think I can remember my ABCDE, i.e. age, blood pressure fall, so shock, comorbidity, diagnosis, and evidence of bleeding. And like you said, they excluded people who were very low, a 0 on the Rockall score, or had a hemoglobin of greater than 12 or 120. Now, Philip, we at the Best Evidence of Emergency Medicine program here, we do quality checklists on papers we review, and we have a standardized approach to critically appraise these papers. And for randomized clinical control trials, there's 11 questions we ask or reflect upon when judging the quality of the paper. And I'm not going to go through all 11, but I'd like to go through the ones that we were either unsure about or answered no with regards to the quality checklist. And the first thing on the checklist, Philip, was ED patients. These were not ED patients necessarily. We're a little unsure because, yes, they came in through the emergency department, but they did not get randomized into this study until after admission. So after they were already admitted and probably transferred to the ICU into your arms, as opposed to taking place in the emergency department. The other thing we were answered no to in this case was patients and physicians were aware of their allocation. They knew which group they were in, whether it was the liberal group or the conservative group. And another thing that we answered no to on this quality assessment checklist was, were all patients treated equally? And the answer was no, because patients that were identified with peptic ulcer disease, these people all got a proton pump inhibitor, or PPI. They got a bolus plus a drip. And I assume that that's the 80 milligrams and 8, the 80 and 8 strategy. And of course, David Newman, has already done a great posting on that about the NNT, saying that may not result in good patient-oriented outcomes. The other issue was people with portal hypertension received IV somatostatin and prophylactic antibiotics. If you were a patient identified with bleeding esophageal varices, they were treated with bands or sclerotherapy. And non-bleeding varices were treated with injections and cyanoacrylate. But they were not treated equally. The rest of the quality assessments were reasonable and we answered yes to. And I'll put those up in our blog posting. But let's look at the actual results, because that's what we want to find out. We want to find out, did the restrictive versus conservative strategy, was there a difference with regards to mortality at 45 days? And what was the main result?
Well, the main result was that mortality did appear to be decreased from 9% to 5% in the restrictive group. And the important number there, I think, is the NNT, which is 25, which is, you know, I would say mid-range. It's not the kind of number it has an immediate effect, but it's still fairly significant.
I always like it when we get an NNT because I can get my head around that. You know, how many people do I need to treat to prevent that one adverse outcome or that one good outcome? And in this case, you know, mortality, I think that's a pretty bad outcome. And if we treat 25 people with the restrictive strategy or the conservative strategy, we prevent one death. I mean, that's a pretty good win in my case.
Well, especially since this is not like a scleroderma renal crisis that you're going to see once every few years, that, you know, you're in your whole career, you're not going to get an NNT of 25. But you're definitely going to be seeing 25 GI bleeds at least per year.
And when it comes to that, you know, I mean, a 4% absolute difference is what the NNT translates to, right? 5% versus 9%. I mean, that's a real number when it comes to something like death. We're not talking about, oh, we prevented a rash or we prevented, you know, an increase in their pain score. I mean, that's a pretty solid outcome that most people would consider a patient-oriented outcome. And how about further bleeding? Was there any benefit?
Yeah. Actually, you know, and maybe surprisingly, there was. I actually had 16% with the aggressive strategy and 10% with the restrictive strategy, which is a little bit surprising, because there's a lot of sort of common, maybe perhaps dogmatic teaching that in order to make a clot, you have to have a certain amount of hemoglobin, which undoubtedly is true to, you know, an extreme level. If you've got none at all, you obviously can't make a decent clot. But in this case, doesn't seem to be a difference in the 70 to 90 in your ability to clot, and perhaps it's other factors even that permit that lower range of hemoglobin to stop the bleeding better.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting things about this, because for a long time, I think we've had this very mechanical model or a plumbing model of the system that, hey, if blood's pouring out one end, we should just pour it in the top end. And the body's a bit more complicated than that. There's stuff that happens in between those two stages. Yes, you're bleeding, and yes, we should probably give you some blood, but the whole idea that if we just pour it in, we'll fix the problem isn't necessarily true. The body is more complicated than that. It's nuanced. And if you want to think of it, it's a bit like a Goldilocks zone. We don't want to give too much and we don't want to give too little. We want to give just right. And if you're an EBM expert, you're thinking, is the body trying to regress to the mean or find that homeostasis? And the body is more complicated than sometimes we give it credit.
I think you really just hit the nail on the head there. I think, at least speaking for myself and certainly from what I've seen around, we have a very simplistic, almost like you just said, plumbing model of the body in terms of hemodynamics and circulation. And we feel that we can just, exactly like you said, fill it up and it should work again. But it is much more complex than that. And without getting into great detail, I've been certainly, and many others have been looking into this whole glycocalyx issue and the whole microcirculation autoregulation thing. And we can't just look at filling and just squeezing with some vasopressors as a really simplistic thing. And there's actually a lot more going on.
So it's not so black and white. And as my EBM mentor always says, it all depends. And we're getting more nuanced. And hopefully as we gain more information, we get better and better at doing what we're doing. How about the overall adverse events in this study? Was there a difference between the two groups?
Well, even there was significantly less adverse events in the restrictive group, 40% versus 48% in the liberal group. And yet again, your NNT is down to 13 for this.
Yeah, so again, in all categories, mortality at 45 days, further rebleeding, overall adverse events, all favored that restrictive or conservative strategy. What was the author's conclusions in this paper?
Well, they concluded that the restrictive strategy versus the liberal transfusion strategy significantly improved outcomes in patients with acute upper GI bleeding.
So I think that's fairly reasonable. Let's go through the BEAM comments from this paper. We felt that it was a good study asking a very important question. I mean, when to start transfusing in upper GI bleeds, like you alluded to earlier, is something that we've been wondering about. How aggressive should we be based on the ICU literature? And they generated the hypothesis for conducting a study based on the ICU literature. Can you just remind us again what that trial was that sort of kicked this off and thought maybe we should be restrictive with our transfusions?
Yeah, that was Paul Hebert's TRIC trial from 1999. That was from the New England Journal in February 1999.
Interesting that that was, over 10 years ago. And one of the objectives of this podcast is to try to decrease the knowledge translation window to less than 1 year. And this paper itself was published in January 2013. So we're trying to get this in under the wire of 1 year and get people to reflect and question and be skeptical of their current transfusion strategies. Now, there were some concerns with regards to this paper. We had mentioned earlier about the Rockwell score, and there may have been some selection bias based on this Rockwell score because they did exclude people if they were zero on that score. And those were the patients with very low risk of bleeding. So that's not what we're talking about. And we're also not talking about people with massive bleeding. So if you're looking at this study and want to apply it to your clinical situation, you've got to remember that this is not people with minor bleeds, and these are not the massive bleeds. These are the people somewhere in between. We also talked that there was no true control group, but you had mentioned something about this being a reasonable standard of care with the liberal strategy. Wasn't that correct?
Yep.
So most people, if somebody comes in bleeding and they're anemic, are giving them blood. But we also talked about the reasons why there may be more to the story than just topping up the tank. There was also some issue of bias because the study was not blinded. And the authors went through this in fair detail, saying that the bias that was introduced wouldn't affect their primary outcome, But I had some concerns about that because when you looked at the details of the paper, there was 39 patients or 9% major protocol violators in the restrictive strategy versus only 15 patients or 3% in the liberal group. So this suggests that there may have been some more bias than the authors gave themselves credit for in their explanation, because that's a threefold from 3% up to 9% of major protocol violators. Another thing I wanted to bring up, Philip, was that each group did receive one unit of blood up front, and then it was at the discretion of the attending physician when subjective symptoms of anemia developed, massive bleeding occurred, or when surgical intervention was required. And this may have had greater impact on the results than the authors suggested. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about was an important factor that you need to realize is that all these patients in the study got an endoscopy at 6 hours. Is that what happens at your place of work?
Certainly not in the weekend or in the late afternoon or the evening. If you're quote-unquote lucky enough to have your GI bleed early in the morning, then there's a good chance you'll get your upper GI endoscopy within 6 hours. Otherwise, you'll likely have to wait till the next morning, especially if you're in this category.
And that's what I've found as well. I mean, with massive GI bleeds, we get on these things very quickly, and with minor GI bleeds, they tend to wait. And the ones in the middle, they're stable, but they're bleeding, and they're not rushing to endoscopy within 6 hours, by and large, at least in the institutions that I work at. And I think that people need to take this into account when they're looking at, are they going to provide a restrictive or a conservative strategy versus a liberal strategy, if there's going to be a significant delay. And in this case, all of the patients got scoped within 6 hours. One thing we like to do is always put the current knowledge in context with the existing knowledge that we already have. And this study does seem to be consistent with the other smaller studies and the ICU literature that you would refer to, and also some of the animal studies looking at critically ill patients or animals with upper GI bleeds. Now, most of the protocol did take place outside the emergency department, but it's important that we be aware of this and that the first unit of blood often gets started in the emergency department, and then we pass it off to our ICU or gastrointestinal colleagues. And certainly the results would suggest that being more conservative or restrictive with your transfusion strategy as opposed to liberal has more benefit and less harm in these patients. And that led us to the BEAM bottom line, the best evidence in emergency medicine bottom line. And that is, when it comes to transfusion strategies for upper GI bleeds, less may be more. So for a case resolution, Philip, I put down that when I saw this patient who was bleeding, not a minor bleed and not a massive bleed and hemodynamically stable, I group and crossed him for a couple of units of blood. I hung the first unit of blood, just like they did in this study, in the emergency department. I gave him his PPI, 40 milligrams IV, and I consulted the GI service. How is this study going to change your clinical application to resuscitation strategy once they get into the ICU?
Well, I think it makes me comfortable in extending my critical care transfusion threshold of 70 to the patients with GI bleed. I think that was a group, just like the acute coronary syndrome group, where, to tell you the truth, I was a little bit torn, because I'm not keen on transfusing, but I always also felt that, you know, someone is bleeding, the evidence doesn't support not giving them blood. Everyone around wants to give blood. It's a little bit hard to sort of apply my sort of physiological N equals one.
Well, isn't it great that we have a study like this where we can add 921 patients to your N of one? Well, yeah. What I do for, you know, patients when I see them with these upper GI bleeds, I have a conversation with them now that says sometimes giving blood can cause more harm and is not helpful. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to check your hemoglobin level before we start the transfusion. And if it's really low, we're going to give you some blood. But if it's not too low, we're going to discuss the case with the admitting specialist like yourself in the ICU or the gastrointestinal specialist and try to figure out what's the best transfusion strategy for you, because we want to give you the best care. And even though this study had 921 patients, and we can talk about percentages, a patient isn't a percentage. We want to focus in on that one patient and try to figure out with their risks and what they bring in on their presentation and our clinical experience, we add the literature to that, and where those three things overlap in a Venn diagram, that's where you get the best evidence. You take into consideration the patient, the physician's clinical experience, and what the literature says. And it's those three things that help us provide the best care to the patients. And isn't that what we all want for our patients, Philip?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly the right approach. I think that's what prevents the pendulum of evidence-based medicine to swing over too far.
Now it's time for the Keener contest, Philip. And last week's winner was Justin Lozer from the University of Ottawa. I hope I said his name correctly. He knew that Allen Ginsberg was the poet who wrote the poem Howl. Oh! And apparently Allen Ginsberg, not Justin, apparently used nitrous oxide for recreational purposes. So congratulations to Justin. I will be sending you a cool skeptical prize. And Philip, apparently you have a really good Keener contest that involves transfusions for our listeners.
So it involves transfusions and urban legends. If anyone can tell us what the name of the surgeon was who pioneered techniques for preserving blood plasma in the 30s that saved countless lives during World War II, he later became medical director of Freedman's Hospital in Washington, D.C. And now the urban legend starts. In 1950, while driving three other African-American physicians to a conference in Alabama, he unfortunately fell asleep at the wheel. Swerved, rolled over. Unfortunately, he broke his neck, crushed his chest. And according to the legends, he desperately needed a blood transfusion, but apparently doctors at a hospital refused to admit him, and he died. This obviously goes back to those segregation days. But apparently, Dr. John Ford, one of the passengers in the car, debunked that myth and said that they all received the best of care, and they just started treating everyone immediately, and that he just unfortunately died of his injuries before anything more could be done.
So thank you for giving such a good Keener contest that involved not only a question, but an urban legend when it comes to medicine. So if any listener knows the answer to who that surgeon was that was involved in transfusions and the pioneering of transfusions, then just send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener contest in the subject line. And if you're the first one to correctly answer the question, I will, of course, send you a cool skeptical prize. Well, Philip, I really want to thank you for being on the SGEM. It's great to have someone in the critical care arena join us and help us understand where we can apply this literature on upper GI bleeds and transfusion strategies. So I think it's a great example of that continuation of high-quality care from before the patient arrives at the hospital, in the emergency department, and all the way up to the ICU. I really appreciate your wisdom and insight.
Thanks very much, Ken. And again, thank you for inviting me on the show. I feel very honored. And keep up the great work and continue us in supporting everything, the whole phone movement, which I think is a pretty awesome thing.
Well, you keep writing those great blog postings, and I'm sure we'll be talking again. Would you do me the honor of giving the Skeptic's Guide tagline?
So remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to people next week.